So the real value of resolution theory, it's great to understand those pieces of a change and to know where you are when you're there.
And ask yourself, where do I fall down? Mm-hmm. And if I always fall down in the same spot, what can I do when I'm in this spot to overcome that failure?
Absolutely. But more importantly than that is to start to understand that as we started to roll it out, we started to realize that it has a whole other dimension, which is that any person that you know is likely very strong at one of these and very weak at one of these and moderate at the rest. Mm-hmm. And when you talk through this and when you heard this, you probably felt like one of those phases you said, yes, that is what I'm good at. That is what I do. And one of these phases you said, yep, that is where I fall down every single time.
Yep.
We can generally pretty easily self-identify what we're good at and what we're not good at. Welcome to The Critical Path with Mary and Jason and Dakota, a podcast about business development, company culture, and loving the place you work just a little bit more. This is episode 20. That's kind of a milestone, right?
It is.
We made it 20 episodes. And we are talking about something that we talk about a lot in our day-to-day life.
I think if this were a wedding anniversary, you would get paper.
Maybe wood?
I don't know.
Maybe like a piece of driftwood off the beach?
Just one old log.
Okay. So what are we talking about today?
I want a watch. Made of driftwood.
No, that's like...
driftwood arms.
That's like episode 70.
No, that's a real watch, but a watch made of driftwood that doesn't actually do anything. It just looks like a watch.
Oh, so
a sundial.
Yeah.
So a watch-shaped piece of wood.
Yeah, a watch-shaped object.
Got it.
We are talking about resolution theory.
What?
So, what's resolution theory, Jason?
Oh, resolution theory. This is a proprietary, trademarked... concatenation? Is that a thing?
So something that we talk about a lot is the fact that we are in the business more than anything else of helping people to change. We help people make the changes that they need in order to change the result of their day-to-day life. And the truth about change is that change in and of itself is really freaking hard.
So different people have tried different ways to make changes in their life, and many times they're unsuccessful. I'd say most people are unsuccessful at making any meaningful change. That's taking my pessimistic route, I guess. But the truth is that change is hard. Doing anything different than we've done it 100,000 times before is hard because we are creatures of habit above all else. And likely we spend more time helping people unlearn things than helping them to learn new things.
It's true. So one of the things that we believe is that it's always easier to walk through a difficult process when you understand the process that you're walking through.
So you can see what's coming.
And so early on in arcade days, we came up with what we call resolution theory, and it's really one of our first kind of models that we built. And resolution theory says that every time you undertake a serious change, you go through the same five steps. So this is kind of the same, along the same lines as the stages of grief.
Denial, acceptance, laughter.
A lot of chocolate.
Yeah.
Acceptance?
Acceptance. I like it. Do we have acceptance in ours, in resolution theory?
Kind of.
Okay.
I feel like reevaluation is kind of acceptance.
All right.
So.
Wait, spoiler alert.
Ooh.
I know, right? I jumped the whole queue.
Okay, start over.
So the truth is that when we go through changes, we as human beings tend to just move through these same five phases. And so we wanna talk about what those phases are and what it looks like. So the best way to talk through resolution theory is using something that's kind of a universal piece of change that most of us have experienced at some point or another, which is we decide we probably need to get more fit.
Always be fit.
I think most people at some point have experienced that. And so...
it's usually after Thanksgiving, but you know what? I'm going to wait until after Christmas.
Do you remember how your brother used to train for Thanksgiving?
Yeah, he would stretch his stomach out.
He would eat as much as he could for days before.
Yeah.
And then he would find a special pair of pants that could be his Thanksgiving pants.
It was a whole thing.
It was a whole thing.
Yeah.
So...
What a stellar gem.
What a queen. That's what Cadence would say.
Yeah. So the first step
is resolution. So the first step is the point where you decide a thing needs to change.
So I've heard that word before, resolution. Mm-hmm. And most often it's used in New Year's resolution context, mm-hmm. that I want to change, I want to do something. And so we essentially create that fictitious landmark that is New Year's, mm-hmm. to mark the beginning of something new. Mm-hmm. Right? It's a chance to get some extra boost or initiative to take on a new challenge and do something different that we wouldn't normally do on March 14th.
Right, exactly. So resolution is the point of not just knowing a thing needs to be done, but actually resolving to change the thing. So we can walk around all the time and say, man, one of these days, I got to start going to the gym. One of these days, I'm gonna do something about this.
One of these days, I'm going to paint the house.
Yeah, absolutely.
But you know what? That day is not today.
So resolution is when we say, I'm going to paint the house and I'm going to do it next weekend. It's when we say, I am going to start going to the gym. I'm going to start getting fit and I'm going to do it beginning of next week.
So the first half of that is recognizing that there's something that needs to change, so you're able to see the problem, mm-hmm. and then you're able to make the determination that, yes, I'm invested in making this change, and I'm going to do something about it.
Yep.
But we haven't defined what we're going to do. We're just defining that we're going to do something, mm-hmm. and that's resolution.
Yep. Resolution is basically just deciding to do something. So the second phase, once we've decided to do something, then we move into what we call the conception phase. So this is where we decide what we're going to do. So if I'm painting the house, then I gotta pick colors. I gotta pick what sheen do I want on my paint. I gotta pick what quality paint I wanna use. Am I gonna use rollers or a paint sprayer?
Mm-hmm. Are we gonna do the trim? Are we gonna paint the windows or not?
Are we gonna paint the cabinets?
Right, are we doing one side before another? Is mm-hmm. there one side that's more important than another? Am I going to pay somebody else to do it? Am I going to ask family to come over and do it? There are a whole myriad of choices, mm-hmm. when we're going through conception, because now we have to create the plan for how do we walk through that change.
Mm-hmm. And as we walk through the phases, it's important also to identify what do the failures look like, mm-hmm. in those phases. So we just talked about resolution phase, and I think it's really easy to understand what a failure looks like there. It's when we just never get to the point where we decide to change a thing.
Yep.
If we never get around to making that decision, then we failed in resolution.
And I guarantee everybody listening has known somebody or has been this person at some point who recognizes that there are people in the world who never resolve to do anything.
Mm-hmm.
They never resolve to make any change. They oftentimes don't quite recognize that there's even a problem. Or if there is, they don't make the determining statement that I'm going to do something about it.
Or they recognize there's a problem and don't believe that it's possible to do anything about it.
Yep.
That's another one.
It's just, my job is always going to be this way.
Mm-hmm.
That's just how
it
is.
No one can do anything about it. This is just the way our world works. Mm-hmm. So once we move then into that conception phase of deciding what you're going to do, the failures there, you see two kind of main schools of thought of how we fall down in conception phase. So one is I'm overwhelmed. One is, so when we talk about fitness, let's say we're going to change our diet. There are so many different diets right now. There's keto, there's paleo, there's Whole 30,
yep.
There's being vegan, there's Atkins. I guess now it's just modified Atkins. But there are all kinds of different books you can buy and choices you can make. And if you feel like there are just so many to make that you can never settle on just one, that's a failure of being overwhelmed in the conception phase.
Don't forget about Weight Watchers.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. But
Isn't
so
Oprah own Weight Watchers or something?
We don't want to talk about that. So
is there a failure in conception where you just immediately naysay before you even really get the options? Like, oh, I really want to get a new car. But then you immediately, like, hate the concept of, like, shopping and buying. Would you say that that's a failure in conception?
No, because you don't have to start shopping for it to be in conception. But if you say...
It's the thought of shopping. Thought of all of that.
I still think even if you... So the shopping is, like, more like the implementation. So if you don't move forward because you don't want to shop, then I still think that's probably an implementation failure. It's that you never get to implementation because you're avoiding it. The failure in conception is more like I need a car that is this color and goes this fast.
Holds this many people.
Holds this many people, and that car doesn't exist on the market in my price range. Mm-hmm. So I'm just, I don't know.
So you
I can't
kind of,
pick one.
You kind of rule yourself out.
Yeah, the car doesn't exist that I want, so I can't pick a car.
But in conception, we're really talking about creating a plan, right? We want to create mm-hmm. a plan. What is the plan? Whether we're talking about diet or buying a car or doing something different, what does that plan look like? And we have to build the plan. Doesn't mean we have to carry it out. It mm-hmm. just means we have to be able to define what that plan includes.
Doesn't mean it has to be a good plan.
Mm-mm. Could be a terrible plan.
Just have to be able to build a plan.
Yep. And so
a way to proceed.
Oftentimes the failures, we talked about failures in conception. Sometimes people just can't conceive of what a solution looks like. Mm-hmm. They just can't, there could be a deciding aspect to it, but there's also a creation aspect that I just can't come up to with a solution for this problem.
Mm-hmm. Well, and again, so it's usually one of two things. It's either A, there are too many solutions and I can't pick one, mm-hmm. or B, there are no solutions, so I can't do this.
Yeah, or I can't make one.
Yeah. So that is what conception phase looks like and what the failure of conception phase looks like. So
oftentimes companies and people will go to the trouble of defining resolution and then mm-hmm. go to the trouble of conceiving what that solution looks like and kind of skip the next step, which the next step is can be the most difficult mm-hmm. and it can be the most challenging, but this is where the rubber starts meeting the road.
Yeah. So implementation is when you do the thing. Mm-hmm. So like we talked about, if you have resolved to get a car and then you define the kind of car you want, then implementation is going shopping and getting the car. If you're doing a personal workout, then it would be showing up Monday morning at the gym. But within a company, when we're dealing with a whole group, there's another piece to implementation that we often miss. We know that showing up at the gym is what we need to do. But then when we decide we're going to roll out some new initiative at the company, we think if we just start doing it, then we're home free. We're good. But the truth is there's an internal marketing piece here. We need to make sure everyone knows what we're going to do. Everyone understands what we're doing and what it means. Everyone has a chance to ask questions and really know how this thing works that we're about to start doing at the company level.
A common challenge that we hear about all the time is the company's decided that they're going to purchase an expensive piece of software. There's mm-hmm. a new piece of software that they're rolling out. They've identified that they have a need for the software.
Mm-hmm. They picked the software that they think is best.
Yep, they're all ready to go. They paid the money. And then they get to implementation and just completely drop the ball. Mm-hmm. So they don't communicate what the plan is. They don't communicate the value of the plan.
Mm-hmm.
They fall down when it comes to training how to use the software.
Mm-hmm.
And they fail in making sure that everybody is an active part of that new change.
Absolutely. And there are two main components of what you're talking about there, because before we ever bring that software out and expect people to start using it, the first piece is we need to get people excited about using it. Because if they feel like we're just adding to their trouble, like this is just going to be a pain in the ass for them,
mm-hmm.
then they aren't ever going to want to learn it. They aren't going to want it to work. And the truth is, if your whole team doesn't want a thing to work, even if they dutifully go and take the steps and do the thing, it's so much less likely to launch.
Yep.
It is so unlikely to launch and be successful because they don't want it to work.
So this is the difference between having a chorus of people telling you you're fat and you can never change,
mm-hmm.
or having a group of cheerleaders who are cheering you on and saying, yes, we're all part of this, we're all in it together.
Mm-hmm.
You're much more likely to make it across the finish line.
Yep.
In that model.
Yep. So the first thing is that company marketing aspect where we need to roll out and talk to the team about why we need the thing, make sure they agree with us that we need the thing, do what we need to convince them and help them understand why the new thing is going to be better for them, not mm-hmm. just for us.
Yep.
Because that's another thing. Often teams have the idea, they say, that's great, they changed this, and it's for them, it's for their purposes, yep. and it doesn't benefit us.
It's more money for the company, it's a headache for me.
And if you can't explain to them why this is gonna make their job easier and better, you should kick back to conception and make sure you picked the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
Because if it's gonna make everyone else's jobs harder, for the purpose of the bottom line or for the purpose of the accounting department's ease, then it's not necessarily the best solution.
So
the second part of that is once everybody's on board and everyone's excited and ready to do it, We need to train them. We need to make sure they have access to everything they need to be able to roll this out.
So we see this misstep oftentimes, especially in the software world, where new software will be brought into the company, and many times corporate trainers who are agents of that software company come in, and they're not great trainers. They're more along the lines of IT or software brains and less along the lines of teacher brains. And many times we've been brought in to learn a piece of software and train it back to the company because it's super important that you're using that teacher brain to transfer that information and get them excited about using the new piece of software, rather than just having the high-tech technical expertise of how to operate it.
Yep. And if you don't have access to somebody like Arcade who can come in and pinch hit, look at the team who picked the thing, right? So in this case, we're talking about software. Who decided that was the best software? Is there someone in that team who is comfortable with tech and very passionate about why the software is good for you? And could they head up this training effort, even if we have to shift some things and make some room in their schedule and their availability? Because them being able to help everyone on board and answer those questions is going to be really valuable to your company in the long run.
So then the phase after implementation is oftentimes the most difficult.
For me, it absolutely is.
So this is the maintenance phase. And this is the phase where we've resolved to make a change. We've conceived what that change looks like. We've gotten the team on board and we've implemented the change. And this is weeks and weeks into the change. It has not become the new normal. It is not the new muscle memory. This is the, if on your diet, or this is your 5:30 wake up, it's pitch black outside.
Yeah. So for on the personal analogy, if I'm going to work out, the first Monday, the first week of waking up at 5:30, I feel good. I'm excited. I'm doing something.
Determined.
I'm changing my life.
Powerful.
The second week, the third week, as I'm slogging out and it's raining and it's cold and I was up late the night before at some kind of event, and now I just don't want to do it anymore.
This is a Tuesday, 32 days in.
Yep.
It's rainy outside, sun's still not up, and you're in the gym by yourself. Right? That is the maintenance phase.
And it's the same with something like, again, let's go back to your software rollout. So we trained the team. And what you'll often see happen at the company level is they will go back and start using their old tools.
Yeah.
Just on the side, just to help.
Just a little bit. They're just pinch for time.
Just to try to get through this one project. And before you know it, everybody's just drifting back to these old tools, and the new tools are sitting there and being unused.
Yeah.
So this is the maintenance phase.
Yeah. And so I'm sure everybody can identify with that feeling, that experience, that maintenance can be really tough. So it's important that we redouble the efforts to understand this phase is going to be difficult, and we develop some way to keep ourselves accountable and stay on track during that maintenance phase.
Absolutely. And I think probably this is where, well, it's hard to say. It feels like this is where most people fail, but that might just be because that's where you and I both fail.
Yeah.
So that's been a lot of our real world understanding.
So then when you move through maintenance, and you will know that you're through maintenance when the new process, the new behavior is the new normal.
It's your new habit. It is now a thing that would have a cost to change away from.
So you don't even have to think about it anymore. It's just muscle memory and it's just the way that you operate. So it's important that once we pass through that phase, that we come back and reevaluate, did it work? Are there changes that we need to make? And this is the reevaluation phase where we need to figure out, is there a way that we could tweak it to make it better? Are there other changes related to this that would make sense? Are there periodic check-ins that we should be doing as it relates to this change to make sure that it's still being productive?
So we once knew a company who in the early 90s was one of the first construction companies to change over all of their software.
So they digitized everything. They upgraded their software.
Yeah,
across the
I guess
board.
They didn't so much change over their software as they started implementing software.
And software at that point in time was new for construction.
It was a big deal, and it was kind of a cutting edge move. And they bought this very, very expensive software, and they rolled it out across their whole team, and they got accolades, and it was a big deal. And they were considered to be the cutting edge of technology for doing it in, like, let's say 1992-ish, right?
So then over the last 26 years, they've spent $0 upgrading that technology because they did it. They upgraded it in 1992.
And the answer is always like, look, we are the cutting edge because we were the first. We were the first. And it's this huge point of pride, mm-hmm. but they don't ever do anything else with it. So now they are far behind everyone else, but not really aware of it mm-hmm. because they're still holding on to that sense of being the first and being the best.
And I think they're just waiting to retire. The people who made those changes, they did their part and they're just waiting to retire and it's somebody else's problem. But that continual reevaluation is important to make sure that we continue to make progress.
Absolutely.
Okay.
So that is resolution theory mm-hmm. in a nutshell. So now that we understand what it is important to talk about how that actually interfaces with what we're doing.
Mm-hmm. So how does that apply to the real world?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. So the real value of resolution theory, it's great to understand those pieces of a change and to know where you are when you're there.
And so ask yourself, where do I fall down? Mm-hmm. And if I always fall down in the same spot, what can I do when I'm in this spot to overcome that failure?
Absolutely. But more importantly than that is to start to understand that as we rolled this out, initially this was just meant to be a model to understand what is happening as those changes happen. But as we started to roll it out, we started to realize that it has a whole other dimension, which is that any person that you know is likely very strong at one of these and very weak at one of these and moderate at the rest. Mm-hmm. Generally, and when you tell this story, when you talk through this, and when you heard this, you probably felt like one of those phases, you said, yes, that is what I'm good at. That is what I do. Mm-hmm. And one of these phases, you said, yep, that is where I fall down every single time.
Yep.
We can generally pretty easily self-identify what we're good at and what we're not good at.
So when someone is really good at resolution and not great at everything else, what does that look like?
We should fix this. We should fix that. That's garbage. Mm-hmm. That.
This is a problem.
It's all right mm-hmm. enough, I guess.
Yeah. And mm-hmm. we need to do something about it.
In all fairness, I think this is a lot of consultants.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of consultants come in and identify the problems.
Yeah.
And then people are like, okay, how do I solve it? And they're like, make a plan. Do the plan. Bye.
Money, please.
Here's our bill.
I know.
But so the truth is that these are people who are, and these I think are people who naturally can be very critical mm-hmm. of the world around them. They are quick to point out problems that they see, but don't necessarily have solutions for those problems. So people who are strong at conception tend to be people who I think live in a lot of kind of chaotic thought. People who have a lot of big ideas, mm-hmm. so many big ideas that they aren't really sure how to even begin putting the rubber to the road.
When I look at the conception phase as a problem-solving phase, so mm-hmm. that if we're looking at conception skill set, mm-hmm. if you're good at conception, mm-hmm. you're good at coming up with solutions. It doesn't mean that they're good solutions, mm-hmm. but you are gifted at coming up with an idea mm-hmm. for what could be done to resolve this.
I think conception is the most common phase that we see business owners who are good at.
Mm-hmm.
We often see entrepreneurs who come in and talk to us, and they always have ideas. They have so many ideas.
Mm-hmm.
And they have so many ideas that they can't necessarily ever quite piece it together.
Can't quantify it.
To make it happen.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of the opposite of blank paper syndrome. They'll mm-hmm. get a blank piece of paper like, oh my God, I got all these things.
It's so cool.
I can fill it with
yeah.
so many things.
Yeah.
And so this is another, it's funny that your brother's coming up again,
mm-hmm.
but something I always associate with your brother, who mm-hmm. was a business owner, who was
yeah.
an entrepreneur, who fits this mold perfectly, is he had a back porch, and the back porch was like his office. And
he had so many dream boards.
The walls were covered in sheets of paper that had plans,
yeah.
goals, dreams. How was he going to make it happen? What was he going to do? He had so many plans, and he wrote them all down and hung them up so he could mm-hmm. remember them and
yeah.
then never actually figured out how to implement them.
Yeah. So then implementation is, we see this piece missing more often than not in
mm-hmm.
the businesses that we work with,
mm-hmm.
that they'll spend the money and the time for resolution. They'll spend the money and the time for conception, and then they start the implementation phase and drop it like a hot rock.
Mm-hmm.
Or they don't know how to get the team on board
mm-hmm.
as part of that change, and they walk away from it.
Mm-hmm.
And they then blame the team or blame the people on the idea that it was their fault that it failed. They did everything and they gave it to them, but mm-hmm. if we fail at implementation, it's a huge cost for everybody. So implementation skill set looks like you understand what it takes to get people on board. Mm-hmm. You understand how to get that information into people's brains mm-hmm. and get them motivated to want to make that change.
Yep.
So what do you have to do to get them to want to jump through the hoop?
Mm-hmm. So implementation is where you and I both, I think, sit. Mm-hmm. And I think it's interesting because your role in implementation is being that person who can kind of be the cattle prod, mm-hmm. hold people accountable.
Yeah.
So I think people who can hold people accountable, that is what you see with people who are strong in implementation. Mm-hmm. And then also people who are good at understanding how people work.
Yeah.
So I can look at people and say, I think this is where you're stuck. I think this is what's going wrong. And here's how I can get that out of your way. Here's mm-hmm. how I can help you. And so between the two of us, we're really good at implementation. But I think either way, either of those are two different ways that implementation personalities can manifest.
So maintenance, what does a strong maintenance person look like?
So someone who is good at maintenance is someone who likes to turn the crank. Someone who doesn't want to generate new processes and make new things happen. They like the old way. And they like to just do things that way. And if you hand them a thing, you hand them a way to do it, mm-hmm. and they will just do that thing over and over and over again. Mm-hmm. Maintenance personalities are not the kind of people who are super likely to get bored. I think maintenance people often feel a certain level of fulfillment from checking the boxes, mm-hmm. from running the process. And the more they run it, the more they know they're doing it right, mm-hmm. and that is fulfilling for them.
Yeah. And I think it's easy to look at maintenance like it's less valuable than the others. But in mm-hmm. a lot of ways, finding a good maintenance person can be more difficult to do mm-hmm. Because not everybody fills that role so effectively.
Mm-hmm. When you have people who are getting bored in their jobs, that can be a good sign because it means, you know, you have people who maybe are looking to grow and looking to change. But when you have those jobs that you really need those boxes checked and you really need those jobs done over and over again, and you have someone who doesn't get bored in that role, but in fact remains fulfilled by that role and likes mastering that process, that's a really strong thing to lean on in your business. And we're going to talk more about this, but we often find where we take those people and then we just get frustrated with them because they aren't implementers and they aren't conceivers, they aren't creators. And we get frustrated and we say, well, they're never going to create anything, so they're not motivated and they don't care. But the truth is, if we can just keep them in that maintenance role, they will be a rock for our company. They will be a timepiece for our company.
So what does reevaluation look like in a person?
Well, so this is the place where you and I have a little bit of discordance, I think, because mm-hmm. to me, I feel like reevaluation is really just resolution phase all over again. Mm-hmm. Once it's done, then do we see problems? And if we see problems, then we really just start the whole process over. Reevaluation and resolution, in my mind, are pretty much the same thing. Mm-hmm. And so I would say that there wouldn't so much be a specific person who's good at reevaluation, because mm-hmm. the person who's good at resolution would basically kick back in at that point and say, let me pick out all the problems with this thing.
But I think the differentiation between reevaluation and resolution is the idea that when we understand the purpose of reevaluation, it's to make an intentional stop. We're not waiting to see or detect a new problem. Mm-hmm. We are evaluating how we did and how effective was that solution, even when there isn't a problem.
But a person who's good at solving problems mm-hmm. isn't just good at only solving new problems.
No.
They see all the problems around them all mm-hmm. the time.
Yeah.
And
but
so
I see the reevaluation as a step, as a phase, as mm-hmm. something that we need to make sure we do, rather than just fixing it and moving on and never thinking about it again.
Sure, but you can see where, when we're talking about personality types and we're mm-hmm. talking about someone's role in mm-hmm. a change,
yeah.
the role of recognizing that we need a change and the role of recognizing that now we've made our change, it needs improvement, mm-hmm. those are really a similar role.
Yeah. Okay, what's next?
So for any position inside of a company, we can really kind of understand, and this would be different from company to company. So a project manager does not look the same in every single company.
Yeah.
So within the company, what we need to do is understand, for this role, where does this role live on resolution theory? Are we expecting these people to conceive of solutions to problems all the time? Are we expecting this person to take input from someone else and implement those solutions? Are we looking for someone who's going to be in a maintenance role? What does this role require?
So many times we'll say, we need to hire a new project manager or a new project engineer or someone in estimating. We'll define what that role looks like. And then we'll go through the process of trying to fill the role, trying to find an engineer, trying to find that person. But one of the first steps that I'll take when we're evaluating teams is identify, do we have a person on the team who's strong at resolution? Do we have a person on the team who's strong at conception? Do we have a person on the team who's strong at implementation? Do we have a person who's strong at maintenance? If we detect that we're all great at resolution and conception, but shit at implementation and maintenance, we have a problem. We have a problem in the balance of our team. So even rather than focusing on trying to find a person who can be a project engineer, we should be focusing on the idea that we need someone who is good at maintenance, or we need someone who is good at implementation.
Oh, absolutely. We need to fill all of those roles in our team, or we can't make it all the way through the process of any change.
Right. So many times, rather than focus on the title of filling the role, we should be focusing on the skill set.
Yeah, but that's not so much what I'm talking about. What I'm talking about is, once we have a position, and we're not even talking about trying to fill that role, we have a position now, and we know that that position is going to spend the largest percentage of their time in one of those phases.
Yeah.
This person needs to be able to be good at maintenance. This person needs to be able to be good at resolution. And I think understanding that about the role and understanding where that person falls will help us understand maybe pieces of a poor fit that exist.
So we'll often hear that a leader is having a hard time, that they'll be given a job to create a new process. And when you look a little bit closer, you figure out that the leader is a maintenance person. That leader doesn't have the skill set to implement or to create new processes. That's not what they're built for.
Well, leaders need to be good at resolution, and leaders need to be good at conception. And I mean, leaders carry a heavy role because I think even you need some implementation in there. If they can't be good at all three of those things, they need to prop themselves up because all three of those things need a leader's input, need a leader's part.
Yeah. So, do you have something?
I did, but now it's out of sequence.
It's okay.
So would someone who like worked the front counter somewhere, would they be like really expect to be good at maintenance because, you know, they're turning the gears, right? They're doing the same almost mundane but not necessarily mundane task every day, but, you know, like maybe a minor in resolution. They don't necessarily need to reimagine every new process. They don't need to find the best way to make that process. But they do need to be able to turn the crank, to move the ball. And, you know, if there is a problem, say, hey, guys, maybe that should get fixed.
And they're not necessarily the person to create that process or make that change happen, but most certainly they're the person who's turning the crank and most certainly the person who detects when something is off.
I've often, in my past experiences,
They can't see the air quotes.
Air quotes.
Oh.
Past experiences. Air quotes. Where someone's like, hey guys, it'd be really cool if we did this. And then the leader looking to, like, give them an opportunity, like, oh, yeah, prove your mettle. Let's do this, team. Say, okay, build it. And the other person's like,
I don't know how to build it.
What?
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
Help? No. Do it yourself.
Yeah, well, and I think the truth is that really a good way to look at it is that anyone in our team, whoever has that resolution skill, that's not necessarily expected of them. You know, when you're working the front counter, just being able to turn the crank is the main part of your job. So then if you do catch that resolution and go flag, this thing needs to happen, that's like a bonus. And we need to understand it that way instead of going, well, then you fix it, right? Because then we're not only expecting them to have the resolution role, but the conception role and potentially the implementation role. We go, well, if you're going to complain about it, why don't you fix it? Instead of hearing that and going, that's good. It's always nice that I have someone on the team who can flag these things to me since I can't always see them as a leader. What can we do about this?
So even if they look like they might be, air quotes, a problem employee.
End air quotes.
Maybe we can then, you know, understand like, oh, thank you for stepping out of your almost designated role in doing this. It's not a problem. You're simply pointing out a way that we can improve, because if you are a leader or you run a business or you have a team and you think that everything's perfect and we never need to change, you're basically a tree stump, right? You're not going to grow. You're just going to be there. Mm-hmm. And people might be like, that's a really pretty tree stump. But at the end of the day, you're just going nowhere.
Yep. Well, and a good way to redirect that is if you have somebody who it complains. Mm-hmm. When they complain to you, rather than reacting to them like they're a complainer or react to them like by complaining back about other things that suck about the company, someone comes to you with a complaint and says, well, this really doesn't work and it really sucks. And you go, so basically you're telling me that we should look into changing the way this is done. Thanks for the input. And when you react to a complaint as though it were a suggestion and then thank them for it, sometimes you can take that complainer personality and help them turn that around. Mm-hmm. Because
it's a resource.
Yeah. And people who are good at resolution, I think they often fall into that complainer role where they see problems all around them, and then that can just kind of shift you into someone who complains all the time. And when you hear that and act like you heard a suggestion instead of a complaint, that can help them redirect that energy.
So it's important to understand in different positions, how much time should we be spending in each one of those phases? Mm-hmm. And do we have the right people in the right spots to mm-hmm. be able to be successful at their core for those roles?
Absolutely. So we talked about how leaders need to have kind of the whole first piece that, and again, I mean, leaders should always work to be good at all phases of this mm-hmm. as much as they can, even though they're, again, we are weak at maintenance. Mm-hmm. That's just true. And we have all kinds of ways to try to prop that up in ourselves. But the truth is that is always going to not be our natural happy place. Mm-hmm.
So there's a concept called the Peters Principle that is promote to failure. And the idea behind this is, let's say you're a carpenter and you're very, very good at your trade and you get promoted into a foreman. The skill set that you need to use is completely different between carpenter and foreman. And mm-hmm. let's say you struggle, but you happen to make it through and you're doing okay as a foreman. And then you get promoted again to superintendent. And the role of a superintendent is different. The toolbox that you're using is different from that of a foreman and a carpenter. So it's important that we recognize that. And just because they're a person is good at a thing doesn't mean that they're going to be good at the next thing.
Mm-hmm.
Because
Absolutely.
The next thing is oftentimes very different and requires a different mix of these change components to be able to be good at those roles.
Mm-hmm. So in looking at kind of some of the different kinds of roles that exist in companies and what skill set they tend to lean on, you know, if you look at an accounting department, you're likely going to find a lot of maintenance people.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, too, depending on the trade, a lot of trade stuff, you're going to find maintenance people.
Mm-hmm.
Anytime that you're doing a trade where you're doing much the same work over and over again, where it's not so much where your day-to-day isn't necessarily identifying the problem and finding a creative solution.
It's closer to factory work, mm-hmm. or a lot of prefabrication looks like this.
Mm-hmm.
Many times when we're doing the exact same thing over and over and over again, and we find people who are happy to do those things,
mm-hmm.
those are strong maintenance people.
They stand back and say, look at this, another job well done, mm-hmm. another day that I did my job perfectly, and this looks beautiful because I know this trade. That's maintenance.
Yep. And we have several examples of, let's say, project managers, and then they get promoted into leadership, and they are maintenance people through and through,
mm-hmm.
and fail and fail and fail again in that leadership role because the skill set requirements change.
Mm-hmm.
So in the leadership role, we're looking for resolution, we're looking for conception.
Mm-hmm.
They need to be able to create the solution to the problem,
mm-hmm.
and be agile enough to be able to react to the change conditions.
And be able to implement it.
Mm-hmm.
Be able to roll that out and make it happen.
Yeah. So when we see failure in those situations, we need to evaluate, does that person have the right qualifications, not from school, but from their core material? Are
mm-hmm.
they good at the thing that I'm asking them to do or not?
Mm-hmm.
Many times we're asking them to be great at things that they're really not great at.
And sometimes there are changes we can make to the org chart. Sometimes we don't have to necessarily move that person into another role. Sometimes we can break those responsibilities up in such a way that we're supporting them by other people on the team who are good at those parts. And, you know, so we could hand some of that conception and implementation off to other team people who are good at it.
We could create a task force.
Absolutely.
That is, we have new software
mm-hmm.
Identification and implementation task force.
Absolutely.
That we're going to, their skill sets are strong in those areas, and we're going to lean on those people to get it done.
Yep, Absolutely. So other roles that have need of specific skill sets, when we see people who are teaching or training, mm-hmm. whether that's software, whether that's out in the field, then it's good if they have some skill with conception. Mm-hmm. Because being able to turn information in different directions and kind of look at it in different ways is essential to being able to get that information into other people's heads.
Mm-hmm. So another example is HR.
Yeah.
HR is all implementation all the time.
Absolutely.
We're detecting where the problems are, and we're making sure that everybody's on board with the new change that's coming.
Yep.
But it's important that for the role that we're looking at, we should be able to quantify what is the skill set that role needs to be strong in order to be successful. Because mm-hmm. we'll often call a failure of
failure of management.
We'll often call a failure to perform. We'll misdiagnose that as a failure of the person. And rather than, yeah, it would be a failure of management for the reason that we aren't properly putting them in the right spot. And kind of the example that we use oftentimes would be related to like a football team. So if we took a football team and you're terrible at kicking and I made you the kicker, that's kind of rough. If you're terrible at throwing and I made you the quarterback, rough, right? So we need to make sure that we understand the core abilities, especially as it relates to our ability to change and get people into the right places so that they can use their strengths. Because when people use their strengths, that's when they're happy, that's mm-hmm. when they're fulfilled, that's when our team is playing at its best.
Absolutely. So any other roles that you can think of that have need of specialized pieces of resolution theory? Those were the handful that I came up with.
Well, I think oftentimes field foremen, people who are out in the field and they're the front line of defense, they're the eyes and the ears, they should be trained to be very good at resolution.
Mm-hmm. See where things are wrong.
Yeah, they need to be able to detect where the problems are. Are they actually executing the work that they're supposed to be?
Mm-hmm.
Are there change conditions that they didn't expect? I think that those are key skills to watch for. And mm-hmm. some part implementation, mm-hmm. if they need to be good at getting new information out to the team.
Mm-hmm.
So where we spend the majority of our time is part-time in conception, but mostly in implementation.
Yep.
People need help with how to implement things, how to get people on board and motivated, how to communicate what it is that we're doing in the change. And then we help facilitate and oversee the maintenance component of executing those changes.
Mm-hmm. But often our role in maintenance mm-hmm. is actually identifying the person on the team, because
yeah.
we can't really, most of our clients can't just pay us to just be there day after day after day. And that is what the maintenance role is.
Mm-hmm.
So really what that looks like is we find the person on the team and say, this is your maintenance person. And then we communicate with them and help them understand, because that's part of implementation, and then let them roll with it.
I think that's good.
Yeah, I think that's good.
So what else? What was the jetpack?
Oh, we didn't have a jetpack.
So we need to hit conception phase.
That's what I'm saying.
We resolve that there's a problem that we need to do something about it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that was my role. I did it.
Whatever.
So now, conception, let's go.
But maybe we should reevaluate the jetpack.
Ooh.
It might be okay without a jetpack this week.
Get on it, Jason.
So
you're going to leave Jarrett so downtrodden.
The jetpack is Jarrett Pictures. What are you going to do with that?
Jarrett
It's like
pack.
Inception.
Right? Man, those pictures are so good.
What about Jetpack Jarrett?
Jetpack Jarrett?
Huh?
I like it.
Okay, watch for it.
Watch for it.
2020.
Oh, is Jarrett running for president already?
No. I mean, I'd vote for him, but...
Yeah. I mean, what? Every day.
Duh.
I'm going to write him into every ballot.
So much.
You can find us...
Oh, shh.
...at www.thecriticalpathwithmaryandjason.com.
.com. There are like four .coms.
No, just one.
Okay.
Just .com and that's it. It's done. You can find us on Twitter @ArcadeWayfinder. You can find us on LinkedIn at Jason Sturgeon, Mary Sturgeon, Dakota Gates, and the company page that we literally never post to.
We're also on Fingerling.
Is that the new one about potatoes?
It is. If you're a fan of potatoes, check out Fingerling. We're on there.
All of your talk about new social media networks,
yeah.
There's actually a new one that's really different from anything else.
I told you.
Narrative.
Ooh.
That's your buddy.
Is that like hair removal?
It's your buddy Rosemary.
Yeah, O'Neill.
Yeah, Rosemary O'Neill. This is her group's new social media, and they're just launching it, and they're in beta, and it's very interesting. So it's a model that gives, I'm not sure how it's going to play out, but it separates social media into these different subsets called niches.
Mm-hmm.
And then
they're like channels.
Yeah, and each niche has a person who's in charge of that niche, mm. who is like an expert at that subject. So this is kind of an attempt to filter out fake news.
Uh-huh.
And then there is a financial component. So Narrative makes a certain amount, it generates a certain amount of money. And then a piece of that money goes to, and I gather it's a small piece. It's not like this can be instead of your job, but a little bit of that money goes to the niche owners who are basically have a high reputation factor.
Mm-hmm.
So if the people in the niche feel like it's being very well moderated, then they will kind of upvote that moderator. And then there's like a financial aspect to it. So it's very interesting. I
we're on there.
I mean, we are about to be. Actually, I just got the email to go sign up or whatever. So
yep.
I guess we are on
so
there.
So we're experts at Fingerlings.
No, it's not Fingerling. It's Narrative.
Oh.
So that's a cool thing to check out.
We're totally on Mastodon.
We are on Mastodon.
See?
But nobody's going to use Mastodon because it is like for IT people. But it's so good. It's the
nerds.
Best model. I could talk for an entire half an hour about why Mastodon is the right model for social media, but nobody would understand.
That's like next to our how to listen to podcast episode.
Everybody would be like, that's the best idea. I want to do that. And then they'd be like, but wait, I have no idea how to wait.
But
what?
Wait, change?
How
what?
Do I sign up
but
for
Facebook
this?
Facebook is so easy.
It's really complicated, but it's so good.
Facebook actually does Facebook for me.
But Mastodon can't be evil, which is way better.
I think anything could be evil.
Yeah, but
if you do it right.
Well,
you know?
So I could talk about
do it right.
I could talk about how Mastodon protects against evil, but I won't.
Okay. Watch for it.
You can find me starting next week in West Seattle.
It's true.
I'm meeting at this dumb intersection right in front of my new place for at least the next year.
It's Dakota's moving day.
It
watch
is.
For it.
Dakota's
for
moving
it.
Day is the jetpack.
Oh, that's a good one.
Dakota's moving day.
Anybody wants to come out and help out?
Don't. Dakota's got it covered.
Who are all you people touching my stuff? All 70 of you.
And we may or may not be on hiatus next week. I'm not sure. We'll be out of town on
for
vacation.
Whose benefit?
So if we get one cut and edited in time, then it'll come up next week. But if there's no podcast next week, then it's because Mary and Jason finally get a vacation for like 3 days. So
you're breaking hearts.
Oh.
I know. I'm sorry, guys. I'll try hard. I'll try hard to get it recorded and up before we leave.
Watch for it.
Watch for it. Or you could just listen. Well, no.
Okay, I'm going to go check out Fingerlings now. See you later.
It's not a thing, Jason. I would say stay tuned for outtakes, but I don't think there are any outtakes.
There's so many outtakes in there. So many.
I don't think there are. I mean,
so
it's, there's a lot that I'm going to have to delete.
There's so much.
There's a lot that I'm going to delete, but that doesn't make it an outtake.
Okay. Are you ready?
Mm-hmm. I think we are.
Orange juice.
Except for that our thing isn't up.
Shopping list?
Yeah.
Shopping
list. I didn't
list.
Know why you were saying orange juice, but then I looked up at the shopping list and I was like, oh, he's reading the shopping list.
Shopping list. Yogurts.
Resolution.
Five yogurts.
It has been requested that we pick up 4 dozen eggs on the way home.
That'll get us a day. Guy one eats 8 eggs.
And that should be, I bet you we could get through 3 days with 4 dozen eggs.
He'll eat eggs.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, he has no problem with eggs.
Yeah.
Even though they're baby chickens.
They're not.
No, they're not. That's why he doesn't have a problem with it.
God, how dare he be educated.
Yogurts.
Yogurts.
Are we ready?
Yeah.
So you don't have your intro.
Welcome to The Critical Path with Mary, Jason, and Dakota. A podcast about...
Yogurts.
It's not a podcast about yogurts.
Wait, but I brought my list of yogurts I really like.
Welcome to the critical path.
You don't get to do it.
With Jason.
No. Nope.
And sometimes other people. It's really who I can find laying around.
I'm just going to wait here until you're done.
Still waiting. Okay,
you know,
let's
I
go.
Have to edit this.
Let's do it.